It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Manoush Zomorodi. On the show today, altered perceptions, stories about how we each view the world all a little bit differently. We just heard how Alex Rosenthal, who has aphantasia, has trouble recalling memories because he can't visualize them. But many of us do have memories that are very vivid to us.
There, that is the World Trade Center, and
like John Wick's did, who can picture exactly where he was on the morning of 9/11.
Devastating happening this morning there.
My memory is I was standing just outside my kitchen. My wife was inside the kitchen. There was a friend of ours over at our house visiting. She was bringing her kids over for a play date, and my kids were upstairs. And the events started to unfold, and it was horrifying. And I remember saying that, like, I hope everybody got out of that building. It was so shocking to see that. And the woman who was visiting our house said, I can't help but think of all the firefighters who just lost their lives. And it was chilling to me because I realized she's having that thought because her husband here in San Diego is a firefighter, and she would be aware of the fact that there would have been firefighters, even if all the people got out, firefighters would still be in that building. And that's a crystal clear memory to this day.
So the two of you watching the TV, seeing this happen and her turning to you and saying this, it's very clear to you.
And my wife standing just a little ways away in the kitchen, the three of us. It's crystal clear. I can see it happening right now when I think back to that morning.
If you're old enough, you probably have your own memory of that day, and you've likely shared it with other people, which is what John did a couple years later.
I'm telling that story, and my wife is there, and I thought she'd just chime in and agree with me. Instead, she said, that's not what happened. I'm like, what do you mean that's not what happened? She said, that woman was not visiting our house that morning. Nothing like you're describing happened. I didn't know who was right. I assumed she was wrong. She just forgot. But then we encountered that woman a few weeks later, and she said, no, I wasn't at your house that morning. You know, we did have a conversation like that, but that was weeks later.
Huh.
And that was amazing to me.
John thinks he may have merged the two memories in his head, but even then, he's not so sure.
Last night, I said to my wife, do you remember me falsely remembering that that woman was visiting? My wife said to me, not only that, you weren't there. I'm like, wait a second. I know that woman wasn't there. What do you mean I wasn't there? Of course I was here. I mean, it's just amazing. I actually don't know whose memory is right.
We've all had faulty memories. John Wickstead has not only experienced them, he studies them. He's a psychology professor at the University of California, San Diego, and the head of the Wickstead Memory Lab.
I like to say that I study all aspects of memory. A lot of what I do is studying how memory works in the brain, the cognitive models.
And for the last decade, he has focused his research on court cases with eyewitness testimony. There's been a long-running debate between those who rely on this testimony and those who say it can't be trusted. But John's lab has shown that an eyewitness account can be trusted if it's collected and used the right way. Take, for example, a case from 1985. A warning, this story includes accounts of crimes of sexual violence.
Jennifer Thompson and Ronald Cotton is the most famous case and has convinced a lot of people how unreliable memory is.
In 1985, a man named Ronald Cotton was convicted of raping a woman named Jennifer Thompson.
Jennifer Thompson, a rape victim, misidentified him as her attacker.
John Wickstead explains from the TED stage.
As she would later recall her testimony from his criminal trial, I was absolutely, positively, without a doubt certain that he was the man who raped me when I got on that witness stand, and nobody was going to tell me any different. The jury understandably found her testimony convincing. Cotton was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison. But Ronald Cotton did not rape Jennifer Thompson. Instead, it was a known rapist prowling her neighborhood that night. Cotton spent almost 11 years in prison before DNA testing finally proved his innocence and revealed the identity of the true rapist, a man named Bobby Poole. Jennifer Thompson's testimony was sincere, but her memory was wrong. DNA exoneration cases just like this one involving confident misidentifications have happened literally hundreds of times, leading many to seriously question the reliability of eyewitness memory.
What did the jury hear? Why did it seem like such a open and shut case to convict a man who actually was the wrong guy?
Well, this crime happened in the 1980s, and at the criminal trial, Jennifer Thompson was, she was asked in front of a judge and jury, do you see the guy who raped you? And she immediately and confidently identified Ronald Cotton, saying, "That's, I'll never forget that face. That's the man who raped me." Hmm. You can just see how a jury would find him guilty.
I mean, it's just tragedy after tragedy with this example, isn't it?
It really is. And the thing is, we look into it further. At the beginning of the police investigation, the police tested her memory using a photo lineup, and Ronald Cotton was in that photo lineup. Hmm. And it turns out what she did on that first test was nothing like what she would do later in that criminal trial. It was not an immediate identification with high confidence. It was the opposite end of the spectrum. It was 4 or 5 minutes of hesitation and indecision and finally landing on his face and saying, I think this is the man who raped me. So very low confident identification.
Hmm.
In fact, the detective's response was something like, you think? You know, police officer wasn't trying to do anything wrong, but that's an implicit demand to change your confidence level, which Jennifer Thompson did.
Wait, so you're saying that the first time that she was asked to identify the perpetrator, she doubted whether it was Cotton.
That's right. She was appropriately uncertain. And another part of this story that's rarely told is that same rapist raped another woman that same exact night in that same neighborhood.
Ugh.
And that witness, 3 years later, also identified Ronald Cotton at his criminal trial. But what did that second rape victim do on that very first test a couple of days after the crime? She looked at that photo lineup containing Ronald Cotton and actually rejected all those faces.
Mm.
So it seems reasonable to suppose no jury would have convicted him had they kept their eyes on that first test. One low confidence, one rejection.
Again, this case is often used to demonstrate how unreliable eyewitness testimony can be. But John says it also shows something else. An eyewitness account can be reliable at first. It's just that as time goes on, memories change and morph. John calls this memory contamination.
Memories are not like video recordings. They're more like evidence from a crime scene, collected by people without gloves, distorting and contaminating it with every touch. Think about forensic evidence like DNA or fingerprints. Everybody knows that forensic evidence can be contaminated and end up implicating an innocent person, much like contaminated memory can. But we don't just dismiss forensic evidence for that reason. Instead, we collect it as early as possible in the police investigation, before it's contaminated, because reliable information comes from analyzing uncontaminated evidence, not contaminated evidence. And the exact same principle applies to memory evidence. Collect it early, before it's contaminated.
So why is that not happening? Why aren't law enforcement and police officers attaching much more weight to that first eyewitness test? Why aren't they treating it like forensic evidence?
Because they just don't understand how memory works. They just don't understand how episodic memories, how easily they're contaminated and how readily they change.
Can we zoom out and talk a little bit how memory works? You know, like memory 101. What happens in the brain?
Well, you have certain brain structures that are forming episodic memories on the fly and in real time. You're forming a memory of what we're talking about, memories of what we're talking about right now. If we back up it to the
John says when the brain transfers episodic memories to long-term storage, it loses some of the more specific details.
You know, context change, and so those details of what happened 2 years ago don't really matter. What your brain needs are the lessons learned from blending across episodic memories. And that's what happens as your memories consolidate in your brain.
And he says every time we reopen a memory, it gets contaminated as well. The brain may alter or lose more details or even add details that were never there in the first place.
If you remember them and start talking about them and thinking about them and other people provide input, your brain processes that input because most of the time, it's probably reasonable to do that, right? You're absorbing information that seems relevant and putting it together with the information that you already have. Memories are changing, and that's all a good thing, except in a court of law where that's a bad thing. And it's not just the police, but it starts with the police. You know, the witness doesn't identify him or does so with low confidence. That's not the best outcome. Let's do the memory test again. Let's use a live lineup this time. And
they want to solve the case, right?
Exactly. They're trying to find the guy. They don't realize they just put the suspect's face in the witness's memory while the witness is thinking about the crime. And they repeatedly test memory, hoping to get the bad guy. That's what they're trying to do, not realizing that each time you test memory, it's further contaminating it. And often witnesses will start to say, you know, I think it might be that guy. He's looking pretty familiar to me. So that's one reason the police don't know. But neither does a judge and jury, and neither does the legal system as a whole. You know, if a witness is having a real-time recollection of that guy committing the crime, that's a prized sort of event at a criminal trial. And these witnesses are not lying. They are telling the truth from their perspective, and they come across as being extremely credible.
Is it possible to do a follow-up interview or identification of a criminal, or is it just then the only thing that's reliable is that very first test? Because after that, you got to introduce doubt.
That very first test, the way I put it, maximizes reliability. Remember, there's two threats to the accuracy of memory. One is forgetting, and everybody knows about that threat because we learn about it from our everyday lives. And the other is what you're asking about, contamination. So forgetting is true memories fading with the passage of time, and contamination is false memories growing in strength with the passage of time. And that first test minimizes both of those threats to the accuracy of memory. You know, you said earlier that we all kind of learn that memory is fallible and unreliable. And my own position is that's the wrong way to think about it. The better way to think about it is that the modern day legal system is placing a demand on memory that memory was never designed to do.
To test memory in a less suggestive way, the police will often show the witness a whole set of six photos. It's called a six-pack photo lineup. One photo is of the suspect, and the others are of similar-looking individuals who the police know are innocent. That way, they can still show the suspect's photo to the witness, but without revealing who they think committed the crime. It's a much fairer way to test memory. And it becomes fairer still when other recommended practices are followed, such as letting the witness know that the perpetrator who they saw commit the crime may or may not be among these photos. And the officer who's administering these photos to the witness should not even know who the suspect is, to avoid unintentionally influencing the witness's choice. When it's done this way, it becomes a pure test of the witness's memory.
Like, let's say I look at a photo lineup. It's a gang member. I'm scared. And I recognize the guy who did the crime, but I tell the police, no, nobody in this lineup committed the crime. And then a couple days later, I call up the police and say, you know what? I was scared. I did recognize the guy who committed the crime. Can you keep me safe? And I'll tell you more about that. And the police might say, yes, we can keep you safe. So what the police will naturally think is, let's do the memory test again, because the witness might very well have been lying out of fear. And my message to the police is, no, don't do the test again. Get the true results of the first test. You know, have the witness tell you on that first test, which guy did she recognize?
And if they miss that opportunity, like, too bad, kind of.
You know, and that's what's almost inconceivable to the legal system. That's why even to this day, they're not doing it. But most of what I do now is working with Innocence Project attorneys, revisiting old cases where people were put in prison based on confident eyewitness identifications at trial. And they've found a whole bunch of cases where, just like Jennifer Thompson, where the witnesses didn't do that on the first test.
John believes there are many people in prison today who were convicted, at least in part, with contaminated eyewitness testimony. To date, John's research has contributed to 5 exonerations in cases like this, and he's hoping to do more, like in the case of a Texas man named Charles Don Flores, who's been on death row since 1999. John believes Flores deserves another day in court. He says the eyewitness testimony has all the hallmarks of being contaminated.
On the first test, the witness described white male with shoulder-length hair. She makes a composite sketch, white man with shoulder-length hair. And, you know, one of the recommendations from science dating all the way back to 1998 is that the photos in the lineup should match the witness's description of the perpetrator. So the photo lineup should have had...
The police suspected Charles Don Flores, a Hispanic man with short hair. So they put together a lineup of all Hispanic men with short hair, too.
And she rejected this lineup. But that's how she first saw Charles Don Flores. He's now in her brain, and you can't get it out of her brain. She was thinking about the crime when that face got in her brain that planted the seed of contamination. And then at trial a year later, she confidently identified him as the man she saw go into the house, and then shortly thereafter, her neighbor was murdered, and he was convicted and sentenced to death. He's been on death row for 26 years now. He's out of appeals, and they're getting ready to set an execution date for him. This very credible eyewitness, on the first test, rejected Charles Don Flores and described a completely different person. No judge has considered that. No jury ever heard it. And so this is a case. It came too late, this new science. And the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals is just like, we're done considering this case. You've already had your appeals. And so they didn't consider the new science. And that's why, you know, a last-ditch effort to try to get the U.S. Supreme Court.
It's going to the Supreme Court?
It just got docketed. Yeah, it's the appeal has been filed with the U.S. Supreme Court. They usually don't weigh in at this late stage, but maybe they will this time because... See, Texas has a law basically saying if there's new science, that's sort of a pathway to an appeal. But, you know, a year ago, the appeal was filed with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Here's the new science. It really applies in this case. This is a death penalty case. We really should pay attention to it. And they denied it without comment. You know, we're not even going to consider the merits of your new science argument. So I still don't know.
I mean, this could open up a whole can of worms, right? I mean, I can only imagine that there are prosecutors thinking so many cases might have to be revisited, right?
And what you just said is a well-known headwind. When that's true, courts are really reluctant to go there,
right.
You know, because things could get a little bit out of hand.
But if people's lives are, you know, this is what justice looks like, right? Science changes what we think, and then we have to apply what we now know.
Yeah, and even if the implications are large, you have to find a way to take it under consideration. Because you're right, that is what justice looks like. We just made the understandable mistake everyone did of listening to witnesses' confident testimony at trial. Understandable mistake, but there's a lot of innocent people who are in prison because we didn't understand how memory works. We have a better understanding now.
That was John Wixted. He's a professor of psychology at the University of California, San Diego. You can see his full talk at TED.com. And by the way, the U.S. Supreme Court will decide later this year whether to hear Charles Don Flores' final appeal. Today on the show, Altered Perceptions. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. We'll be right back.